in your money. Each person can help. Each person can make a difference in your environment. Tucker mentioned that it's important to notice how you spend and where you spend your dollars. And there are things you can do to make a healthier, better planet. Tucker reminded us that, you know, on Sunday, they prepare meals for the week, and that's a family activity that's nurturing for the family and prepares them for the week. So this week, notice things you can do to make the world a better place. Thank you all for being a part of our programming. I'm Cecil. This is More Talk Radio, and I will speak with you next time.
Tune to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. as the bedtime radio show for grown-ups, Gremlin Time, presents By the Dawn's Early Light by Lawrence Block.
This is a case that shouldn't be in the first place, and I'd love to clear it up before they even go so far as presenting a bill to the grand jury.
So for me, you want?
Whatever you can find, Matt. I don't know what there is to be found. But you were a cop, and now you're a private. And you can get down on the streets and nose around.
Tune in this Monday at 11 p.m. Gremlin Times 3D Radio Players present an adaptation of Lawrence Block's short story, By the Dawn's Early Light, right here on Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for New Journey workers and their families in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, reminding you that you can always support KBOO by clicking on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app or website, or by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. On today's Old Mole, we'll be hearing about militarism and war and the damage it does and the work people are doing to stop it. Some of the damage that militarism and war do is to the planetary environment. The United States maintains almost 800 military bases around the world, and each base contributes to the U.S. military being the number one institutional polluter in the world, unleashing toxic material into the soil, water, and air, and pouring over 1 billion metric tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. Code Pink is working to expose this problem and to pressure major climate organizations to oppose militarism. Today on The Old Mole, Lori Mercier talks with Aaron Kirschenbaum, a co-organizer of Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaign. One of the places the toxic footprint of militarism is most deadly is in Palestine, where Israel's bombing of buildings has left at least 61 million tons of rubble, according to UN estimates, and released toxic dust and smoke into the air. Even before the current genocide, over 97% of the water in the Strip was already unsuitable for consumption. The remainder is now being polluted on a daily basis with heavy metals and toxic chemicals from bombs and munitions. Among the attempts to challenge the Israeli destruction of Gaza and its people, destruction which has continued despite the ostensible ceasefire, have been convoys of ships trying to break the blockade. Israel has restricted the movement of goods and people in and out of the Gaza Strip for almost 20 years, and since 2008, activists have sought to break the illegal blockade by sailing through the blockade zone to deliver humanitarian aid by sea. Since 2010, repeated attempts by the Gaza Freedom Flotilla have been intercepted, raided, or attacked by Israeli forces. In the summer of 2025, participants from the Freedom Flotilla Coalition joined the Global Movement to Gaza and the Sumud Convoy and launched the largest in the continuing series of flotillas with 40 vessels and participants from more than 44 countries. Among the almost 500 participants were some from Portland, and later on today's show, we'll hear my conversation with local peace activist Paul Reed about his experience on the flotilla and in an Israeli prison. You'll be able to find more information about our segments, as well as audio for the show, to listen to again or share with others, by visiting the KBOO webpage for our show at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find links to subscribe to the show and to support KBOO by clicking on the red donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. Here's a poem by Iraqi-American Dunya Mikhail, translated from the Arabic by Elizabeth Winslow in 2005 and recently republished in Portside. It's called The War Works Hard. How magnificent the war is! How eager and efficient! Early in the morning, it wakes up the sirens and dispatches ambulances to various places, swings corpses through the air, rolls stretchers to the wounded, summons rain from the eyes of mothers, digs into the earth, dislodging many things from under the ruins. Some are lifeless and glistening. Others are pale and still throbbing. It produces the most questions in the minds of children, entertains the gods by shooting fireworks and missiles into the sky, sows mines in the fields, and reaps punctures and blisters, urges families to emigrate, stands beside the clergymen as they curse the devil. Poor devil, he remains with one hand in the searing fire. The war continues working day and night. It inspires tyrants to deliver long speeches, awards medals to generals and themes to poets. It contributes to the industry of artificial limbs, provides food for flies, adds pages to the history books, achieves equality between killer and killed, teaches lovers to write letters, accustoms young women to waiting, fills the newspapers with articles and pictures, builds new houses for the orphans, invigorates the coffin makers, gives grave diggers a pat on the back, and paints a smile on the leader's face. It works with unparalleled diligence, yet no one gives it a word of praise. That was The War Works Hard by Dunya Mikhail. We turn now to Lori Mercier's conversation with Aaron Kirschenbaum about Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaign.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Aaron Kirschenbaum, who is Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaigner focused on climate justice and cross-movement solidarity. Their work covers Palestine solidarity, tenant rights, abolitionist organizing, and the connection between Zionism, anti-Zionism, and anti-Semitism in the context of social justice. Aaron's research on militarism and climate change has been published in outlets like Common Dreams, Counterpunch, and Hampton Institute, offering critical insights into the environmental and humanitarian impacts of global militarization. Today, we're talking about Code Pink's important War Is Not Green campaign. Welcome to KBOO, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, we rarely see environmental groups list warfare as a key factor in accelerating climate change. Why do you think environmental groups have unheeded the role of militarism in destroying the environment?
Yeah, no, that is a huge question and a really good one. But if it's all right, I might sort of start with just giving listeners a little bit of a picture into what the overlap of climate and militarism is to sort of then go into what is avoided. So in terms of some of the history of Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaign, I think it's helpful to sort of start with some of what's just very obvious to a lot of people, which is that war is killing the planet. The Code Pink started in around 2002 to oppose invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And during that work, we were in Iraq and Afghanistan and seeing a lot of the impacts. So seeing birth defects, seeing farmers unable to grow crops, seeing the horrific destruction of cities, of infrastructure. And I don't think that it's a surprise to many people that this is the case. I mean, when you look at war, the images that I think most people see and that comes to mind for folks is giant clouds of smoke, of fires, of destruction of every piece of infrastructure. I mean, we're seeing that in Gaza right now with the genocide and the ecocide going on. But despite all of this, and I think the fact that environmental groups at that point weren't necessarily as invested in taking on war and the cost of war does speak a little bit to maybe the distance from folks that are at the front lines of confronting war and the war economy. But there also wasn't a ton of research. And then in around 2017, there was a book that some listeners might be familiar with called Drawdown, and it was talking about the most comprehensive plan ever to draw down emissions and carbon dioxide and confront the climate crisis, and war wasn't part of that. And so one of our co-founders, Jody Evans, spoke to him, and the takeaway was essentially that there wasn't any peer-reviewed studies saying that, despite it being a fairly obvious thing. And that conversation led to another one with Netta Crawford from the Cost of War Project at Brown. And there were a few numbers that came out of that. One of that was that the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, the US military, is the world's largest institutional polluter on the planet. If it were a country, it would be the 47th largest polluter. It emits over 51 million metric tons a year. The war on terror, quote unquote, which was of course oil driven, between 2001 and 2017 emitted 1.2 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. And even that doesn't begin to capture the full scale of manufacturing, of contracted shipping, of infrastructure accidents, toxic waste dumps, contamination from our over 800 bases in 80 countries globally, and the operations of allied NATO countries that also buy arms. Or examples like the training exercises that we do in the Pacific, RIMPAC, which is one of the largest maritime training exercises in the world, which is US-led with multiple countries involved. So the more that you dig in and the more you unravel, it all becomes clearer and clearer. But there is just generally a huge lack of education. And this is sort of getting into, I think, why some groups have ignored this. Because just a few years ago at Glasgow, at COP26, it was shortly after this report from Brown was published. And Jody and some other folks from Code Pink went there and was handing out stickers that said war is not green to people, and was asking, did you know that the Pentagon is the world's largest institutional polluter? And I don't know that that was necessarily surprising to everyone, considering, I think, just what people see with their own eyes, but it was a number that was very new to people, and it was surprising definitely for a lot of people. And so to come back to your original question, I think the reason for this comes down to a few things. One is a lack of education. Another is philanthropic red lines, and another is political red lines. And when it comes to lack of education, this isn't a super known fact. In these organizations themselves, there have been cases where it's taken a lot of organizing and a lot of education to bring about some change. At the Sierra Club, they did organize trips to Israel for a long period of time through the Jewish National Fund, the JNF, which plants non-native pine trees throughout Palestine and bulldozes villages. It creates a lack of biodiversity.
That's quite surprising to hear the Sierra Club would be accepting trips to Israel. I mean, just clearly that kind of propaganda.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. And they have shut that down. There was a lot of internal organizing, but a lot of what it took internally from, we had a webinar with Heba Ghassem from the Palestinian Institute for Climate Strategy, who was talking a little bit about her experience there where she was learning some of this. And a big part of it was just genuinely a bit of a lack of education on it. But of course, then there is also the avenue of donors and philanthropic and political red lines. These organizations get a lot of donations organizations. You know, you can point to just small case studies from groups like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which, I mean, for anyone following the news, Bill Gates is apparently changing his tone on this around confronting the climate crisis. But they donate a lot to a lot of these large climate organizations. But, you know, their investments are, they have $16 million in Boeing. They have $2 million in Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, L3Harris, all of these weapons manufacturers. And so when you start to confront the actual driving forces behind the war economy, you start to get into some of these investments. And but at the same time, also, philanthropy also is built on a lot of very individually driven personal investments from wealthy donors that just have sort of their own pet projects or interests. And that's where a little bit more education and bringing this sort of elephant in the room to the forefront can help a little bit. And then just lastly, in terms of political red lines, there are folks that just talk about the war economy or Pentagon spending. But once you start getting into the Pentagon, you start talking about the actual wars, you start getting into understanding the toll of genocide and ecocide in Palestine, of a new Cold War with China, of Ukraine, NATO. This can bring about, of course, attacks from groups like AIPAC or the ADL that attack the anti-war movement. And so there's definitely a lot of fear there. I mean, groups like the Climate Justice Alliance, Earth Justice, Greenpeace have also been attacked recently. And that, I think, happens not just for the sake of appeasing donors and other political allies, but also because of the way that anything that really gets in the way of the war economy is a threat. But still, I don't think that any of that is a reason to back down. We are all facing it, and ultimately, we don't have a choice but to confront what really is one of the greatest threats on the planet. And we have one of the strongest anti-war movements in generations. And so we are ultimately stronger together than we are siloed into these separate spaces.
Well, that's a really helpful explanation, Aaron. And, you know, it points to the importance of education and that, you know, in order to educate, you know, visibility and resources are key to movements and their ability to educate and affect policies. And as you pointed out, environmental groups receive a great deal more in philanthropic donations, something like, I read, $16 billion versus, you know, a very tiny amount that the anti-war movement garners. So that, I think, explains a lot. But let's talk maybe just a bit more about some of the ways in which the Pentagon fuels the climate crisis. And you kind of provided some broad outlines, but maybe you could just dive in a bit to a key example, whether that's military bases or current wars in Gaza and Ukraine. I mean, can you outline just some of the ways in which these interventions and these expenditures really exacerbate climate change?
For sure. Yeah. Just thinking about what the current toll of the genocide in Gaza is, almost all of the vegetation in Gaza has been destroyed. It sits on a natural aquifer, which is where a lot of their water comes from, and a lot of that is through wells. And so when you have something like the toll of destruction, the rubble everywhere, smoke, the impacts of bombs and of bullets, of all the different sort of chemicals of warfare that have contaminated some of this, it starts to eliminate drinking water. It starts to eliminate ability for agriculture. And so it's going to, of course, take decades for any semblance of agriculture to come back and to be able to grow. And of course, I think in Gaza, ecocide, which is the total destruction of the natural environment, has been used as a tactic of warfare there to starve the population. There have been instances where folks have tried to create seed banks to maintain levels of biodiversity. And similar to the assassinations of journalists in Gaza for telling the truth and for that as a method of survival and getting the world mobilized, folks that have tried to create seed banks have also been assassinated. So I think that's just a bit of a picture into what's happened with Gaza and the horrific toll. Emissions-wise, recent estimates have been that the destruction of Gaza has emitted more than 100 countries combined. What it's going to take to rebuild Gaza if Israel stops breaking the ceasefire that it has continuously been breaking since it was instituted, what it will take to build Gaza will also be a huge burden. And so that's just one picture, the most recently. But of course, you also spoke to the over 800 military bases on the planet, and I mean, when you think about the reasons why the U.S. is so invested in Israel's existence to begin with and why there is an ethnic cleansing campaign, it's to secure Israel's place in the region as a proxy state for continuing to secure oil and continuing to wage war across the region to uphold the oil industry. That's been a huge part of the U.S.'s support and why, despite sort of varying tones on the genocide from politicians in the U.S., there's still a refusal to go beyond it in terms of complete support for the Israeli project. And that's also why we have over 800 military bases in 80 countries that completely neglect any sense of sovereignty and any semblance of respect for the people there. Some of it is in strategic places. We have around 60 on the Korean Peninsula. There have been instances there where there have been jet fuel leakages. But because every one of these bases across the world is a piece of U.S. territory, the countries, quote-unquote, hosting these bases don't have any ability to clean it up. And so there have been jet fuel leakages that have stalled in cleanup in the Korean Peninsula for a long period of time because they're not able to actually access the base to do that cleaning. And that, of course, is devastating for local environments. And the 60 on the peninsula is essentially to create an unsinkable aircraft carrier, self-described by Pentagon officials, for increasing militarization in war with North Korea, with China. There have also been cases of leakages in one of the most well-known is in Red Hill in Hawaii, where in 2021, a jet fuel leakage poisoned 90,000 people's drinking water, and they've still yet to fully complete the cleanup and close the facility. There is known chemicals in all of these bases like PFAS, which is a carcinogen. There have been instances like in Vieques off the coast of Puerto Rico in the archipelago that was used as a bomb testing site for decades since the 50s till around 2003 after a mass protest movement evicted the base. But it was a bomb testing site and created, in as of 2017, lung cancer and bronchitis was up to 280% more likely among women than the mainland of Puerto Rico and 200% more likely than men. There was 80 million pounds of munitions dropped and dozens of materials that have still made the land, despite it being a animal preserve now, unable to be used and still infects people to this day. And a lot of those bombs, of course, went on to be used in Palestine. And these connections, when the protest movement was happening, were really crystal clear. I think in all of these examples of places that are on the front lines of resisting militarism and ecocide, they understand those as a joint struggle and that it's the struggle for the land, is the struggle for sovereignty, is the struggle against U.S. militarism, U.S. imperialism. And in Vieques, you had fishers participating in these protests, religious leaders, independence organizers, statehood organizers, people from across the mainland U.S., from across the world, recognizing this as one of these joint struggles. And I think you see this in every single one of these because of just how abundantly clear this all is.
Yes. Well, let me interrupt here and just say this is Laurie Mercier for the Olmo Variety Hour, and I'm speaking with Aaron Kirschenbaum, who is Code Pink's War is Not Green campaigner. And Aaron, tell us more about the War is Not Green campaign.
Yeah. So the campaign itself is a overarching campaign that has been present, as I was saying, since Code Pink's creation. And it really is addressing this longtime avoidance, silence, lack of education, lack of unity between what two movements that are considered separate, the environmental movement and the anti-war movement, but that really do have all of the same targets and are going up against the same things. And so it's taken different forms and different moments, but it's essentially a way to grow movements towards seeing where we can support one another, seeing militarism as a joint enemy that we need to confront together. And so right now, what we've done a few things recently. One is our open letter called Environmentalists Unite, War Fuels the Climate Crisis, which collected a few thousand signatures from individuals and over 100 from various organizations, many of whom wouldn't necessarily have signed one of these letters a few years ago, but it encompasses environmental organizations, anti-war organizations, frontline organizations, and is very much so a bare minimum of just sort of acknowledging these relationships, that war is one of the primary contributors to climate crisis, that we can't avoid it, that what the genocide in Palestine has cost, what what the war in Ukraine has cost, in what escalation in the Asia Pacific is doing, but it doesn't actually call for anything. And so it is sort of just this unifying factor to get to the first place that we're trying to get to, which is acknowledging the significance of the crisis. And a lot of organizations, it was incredible to see how many signed on, and it is a huge indicator of change. But some did not. And a lot of these organizations are some of the largest, wealthiest, most well-funded organizations in the country. And so we've launched a sort of new sub-campaign within War Is Not Green, which is the Elephant in the Room campaign. And that name comes from imagery that we've used for a while. We've brought big blow-up elephants to climate protests. We've had that imagery for a while, and it's to say that the cost of war and imperialism and militarism is the elephant in the room in climate spaces. And so we are inviting, not attacking, 12 of the largest and most influential, most well-funded organizations in the country: the Sierra Club, the Center for Biological Diversity, Earth Justice, Project Drawdown, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the National Audubon Society, the National Wildlife Federation, the Environmental Defense Fund, the World Wildlife Fund, the Wilderness Society, Conservation International, and the Nature Conservancy. And
That's quite a list. And Aaron, we'll link, I think, on the Code Pink website that you have that list. And so we'll link to it on our website so that if there are listeners who belong to any of those groups, they can help pressure those groups to sign on to this pledge.
Absolutely. And together, they amount to an annual revenue of almost $4 billion, which is pretty wild. And we are starting with asks to the Sierra Club because it has almost 4 million members and a budget that is made up of a lot of the funds from those members. And a lot of groups in the Sierra Club are already actually engaging in some of this work, which is incredible to see. In Hawaii, they've been trying to resist the militarism that maintains and occupies the land. There are a lot of other groups doing a lot of other incredible stuff, but because of this and because of sort of the shifts that have already taken place there, it's a strategic target to start out with. And not all these organizations are the same. Not all of them are in the same place. Not all of them are going to be as movable or not. But it's a way to both invite and educate their membership, their leadership, philanthropy, get this into much more mainstream conversations that can't be avoided. And we might bring some of these organizations in and some of their members. And if we don't, that is also really clarifying to see what red lines exist, what don't, and why philanthropy and various organizations operate the way that they do. And so it's been great to see the progress that we've made and continuing to talk more with them.
You know, speaking of progress, you mentioned earlier the United Nations Climate Change Conference, I think COP26, when Medea Benjamin and other Code Pink activists launched this War Is Not Green campaign. What about the COP30 meeting now in Brazil? Will anyone there address the role of militarism?
Yeah, so the way I see it is there's sort of two parts of what COP is often. There is the official narratives and negotiations between countries, the various agreements. And then there's everyone else that's there, from climate movements, from local organizations, from big greens. And so it's sort of a hodgepodge of all of that. And so when it comes to the official conference itself, I and most organizers do not expect the cost of war's relationship to the climate crisis to be directly addressed in this. And this goes back years to the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, which was the precursor to the contemporary Paris Agreement. And the US government there lobbied to omit the military emissions in official counting of emissions globally. And this continued under the Paris Agreement in 2015. And now that is still the case, but the US government itself has pulled out of the Paris Agreement. And so I don't expect it to be addressed in the main conference, but there will be a lot, I think, discussed that will be circling around the edges of talking about it. I mean, it's in Brazil, so there's going to be discussions around multilateralism, multipolarity. Brazil is part of the economic and political bloc. BRICS has discussed climate reparations. There's probably going to be a lot of discussions on the fact that the US isn't present and the various tariffs and trading agreements, the role of extracting of critical minerals, which is done and used for war, by war, with, you know, the Pentagon's the largest shareholder of the largest company for rare earth mining in the Western Hemisphere. And so it's in the Amazon as well, which makes a lot of hypocrisy clear. And with tons of trees being demolished for this, folks are coming into Bilem on cruise ships. There was some discussion of that. And so there is going to be a lot of indigenous protesters, the landless peasant movement. There's a counter summit that is going to be bringing up all of this, where there is militarism, working groups, and various constituencies that are going to be hosting a lot of talks and bringing this to the forefront. And that is, I think, a shift from the past as well, how present it is, given, I think, just how unavoidable all of this keeps becoming. And so militarism, in the truest sense, is going to be brought about through the people that are there organizing, and, you know, from journalists that have brought it into conversation in the past. But, you know, the significance of COP is always, I think, what it can do for the broader grassroots climate movement, and maybe now what changing multipolarity can do in the world for this conversation as well.
It does seem like the anti-war movement, the anti-genocide movement of the last 2 years has really helped focus more on local and state investments, how we can, mm-hmm. since the federal government seems to be immovable, you know, not responding to the interest and the will of the 99%. I know here in Oregon, the Oregon for Human Rights Coalition is seeking to require the State Investment Council to use a human rights environmental screen when making investments. And in Portland, half the city councilors have signed a landmark pledge to investigate the manufacturing and transport of weapons to Israel, mm-hmm. Which represents a municipal approach to challenging U.S. complicity in Israel's ongoing occupation of Palestine. So there does seem to be movement towards, you know, recognizing that the United States spends $1 trillion annually on death and destruction, and how we might put those resources to more productive uses. So, Aaron, finally, how can listeners find out more about the Code Pink War Is Not Green campaign and join in this effort?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find out about the campaign overall by going to codepink.org/wing, W-I-N-G, that's the acronym for it. We do have a bi-weekly working group, which you can go to and see at codepink.org/wing signup. You can learn more about the actual campaigns that we're working on, like the Elephant in the Room campaign, by going to codepink.org/elephant and codepink.org/Sierra Club. And finally, we are also supporting Abby Martin and Mike Prisoner's Earth's Greatest Enemy film, which covers all of this and is a really incredible, harrowing, emotional, powerful documentary that definitely, I think, will teach a lot of people a lot. And, you know, some Sierra Club chapters have signed on to it, and a lot of Sunrise Movement chapters. And so it's definitely an opportunity to do outreach. And we have some of the tools for that at codepink.org/EGE toolkit. And actually, for listeners in the Portland area, there is going to be 2 upcoming screenings in the area, and you can go with us to them and talk with fellow Code Pinkers and folks doing this work at them. One is on the 18th in Eugene, codepink.org/EGE Eugene, and one is in Portland on the 30th, codepink.org/EGE Portland. There also is a Portland Code Pink chapter on Instagram at CodePinkPDX. And you can also just follow our general social media accounts. There's the War Is Not Green ones, which is War Is Not Green on both Instagram and Twitter. Code Pink Alert on Instagram and Code Pink on Twitter, X, and most other social media platforms.
Great, Aaron. We'll provide the links on the Old Mole page on the KBOO website. And thanks again for joining us today. Thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you for having me. So bomdali wesulu nomhlaba.
I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world as one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Peace train, take this country. country, come take me home again. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come.
That was some of Dolly Parton's cover of Peace Train with Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And before that, Laurie Mercier talking with Aaron Kirschenbaum about Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaign. As they mentioned, the documentary Earth's Greatest Enemy, about the hidden planetary costs of a global military empire, will be playing in Portland November 30th at 12:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, followed by a Q&A with director Abby Martin and co-director Mike Preisner. You can get tickets at codepink.org/EGEPortland2, that's a numeral 2, and I'll just note that the previous screening in Portland sold out, so if you're interested in that event, you might want to get tickets sooner rather than later. You can also find that link and more information on the webpage for this episode at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and we turn now to my conversation with local peace activist Paul Reed, recently returned from the Gaza Freedom Flotilla.
Listeners to the Old Mole will likely have heard about the global Sumud flotilla, which sailed across the Mediterranean Sea this past summer in an attempt to deliver humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip in defiance of Israel's illegal and inhumane blockade of almost 20 years, controlling the movement of goods and people in and out of the Strip. The flotilla included some 40 vessels and 500 participants from more than 44 countries. 473 of them were kidnapped and imprisoned in Israel. This was neither the first nor the last such flotilla to attempt to deliver humanitarian aid, though it was the largest so far, larger than all the previous flotilla missions combined. Here today to talk with us on the Old Mole about this is one of the participants from Portland, Paul Reed. Thank you for your work, Paul, and thank you for joining us on the Old Mole.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be with you.
Can you tell us how you came to join the flotilla and what the project aimed and aims to accomplish?
Well, Palestine has been a topic that I've been tracking for over 20 years, and I have felt especially drawn to that issue just because of the U.S. complicity in it. And so it's been what feels like the work of my life. And I have also had sailing experience and have experience working with media as a designer. So all of those came together to motivate me to get involved with the flotilla. And I had actually signed up to join the Freedom Flotilla Coalition flotilla last year in 2024, but that fell through because Israel sabotaged that mission leaving from Turkey. I've been connected with these flotillas sometime.
And the goal of the flotilla is to bring humanitarian aid, to break the blockade, but for the past 15 years or so, all of those attempts have failed. So since the aid does not seem to be getting through, what else is this series of flotillas accomplishing or working to accomplish?
Yes. What Israel has been doing with its siege on Palestinians in Gaza is considered normal by most countries around the world, and it absolutely should not be considered normal. These are very inhumane policies that are degrading and not even life-sustaining. And so ultimately, the purpose of the flotilla was to create a new normal. And to do that, it requires people to get involved and to get involved in the political process, boycott, do all the things that put pressure on these government entities that are doing these crimes with impunity. What a lot of people don't realize is Israel is imposing this siege just unilaterally, deciding what they want to do for their own political ambitions in historic Palestine. But Gaza is the only place in the world where a person cannot flee by boat. If you are a refugee and need to leave for your safety, you cannot even leave by boat. It is completely surrounded in the siege.
Which is part of what people say when they describe Gaza as an open-air prison.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's got one of the highest population densities in the world.
So the blockade seems obviously inhumane. We've heard a lot of stories about, in particular lately, the starvation, the difficulties of medical treatment, and so on. Just the increasingly unlivable conditions in Gaza, in Palestine, and particularly in Gaza. What kind of humanitarian aid was the flotilla bringing?
My understanding is that over $100,000 worth of aid was carried on our boats and was taken when Israel intercepted those boats. We don't know what happened to all of that aid. I've actually asked a medical worker who's actually from Portland in Gaza if there is any evidence of that aid getting to them. And of course, the answer is no. But I know that on my boat, we had food, so like rice and biscuits and soup mix, and medical aid such as PPE, for example, gloves and masks. And I know we had a big box of EpiPens, but there were many different kinds of aid, mostly food and medical across all of the boats.
All of which was then confiscated by Israel.
Yes.
And Israel did not even wait until you got to the borders of this zone that they are claiming as part of their security. My understanding is boats began to be attacked and harassed far, far from Israel.
Yes, yes. Actually, we were as far as Tunis, Tunisia, when two of our boats were attacked and they were bombed in the span of 2 days. One was the family boat, the other was the Alma. They were our largest boats, and incendiary devices were dropped on the decks of those boats and caught fire, and they had to put those fires out. Fortunately, no one was killed or injured. Then we were attacked at sea, and there was one night where they just dropped bombs on us all night long. They were explosive devices that shredded our sails and broke the rigging holding those sails. So anything that powerful could have absolutely been, they were life-threatening. But again, fortunately, nobody was killed in that event. And then, of course, we were intercepted still in international waters and boarded by Israeli commandos and taken to Israel to a prison there. But even during that interception, we were attacked with water cannons and various means to get our boats to stop.
What was that like? I mean, water cannons, these are the sorts of things there are films of the police in the U.S. using during the civil rights movement to push protesters across the street. I mean, it's very powerful. It's not just a hose. Is that right?
Absolutely. I actually think those water cannons would be also life-threatening. Just the power of them was so strong. They started breaking components of our boat. In fact, one of the hatches started to break from the water cannon, and we had to hold a bucket under it when we were in the cabin just to keep the water from entering. So yeah, if a person was standing on deck with a water cannon that hit them, they would be thrown into the sea. And being thrown into the sea at night is considered a death threat. It's very hard to find people at sea at night.
What happened when the Israelis boarded your boat? I mean, you're in international waters. Did they justify it in any way? Was there any attempts at discourse about this?
Yeah, actually, the VHF radio is the method that you use to communicate at sea officially. And the Israelis did have someone announce on the VHF emergency line a long message that was politically charged, telling us not to violate the international law that they are imposing upon us. And I actually have a recording of our official response to them that also addressed the nonviolent humanitarian nature of the mission. And it was clearly not in violation of any international law. In fact, Israel is the one that has been violating international law by perpetuating this genocide. And honestly, the entire existence of Israel from 1948 and the ethnic cleansing since then.
What languages were these announcements? Was this conversation such as it was taking place in? Your boat had people from many different countries. As I understand, the flotilla was not segregated by nation. How were people communicating with each other on the boat and then when Israel showed up?
Yes, the announcement announcement that was made by the Israelis on the VHF radio was in perfect, not just English, but U.S. English, which I thought was kind of interesting that it was not even someone that had a strong sort of Israeli Hebrew accent. So yeah, English was the official language used for that. But it was actually an incredible experience to be a part of each of these boats because of the number of languages and cultures that were represented in every boat. Every boat had almost as many languages spoken as there were participants on each boat. So it was like a world tour on every boat. And I was actually able to sail on multiple boats during the journey. So it was neat to have that sort of international exposure and to meet so many people that you didn't have to explain Palestine to, that they just got it.
So this was the experience of being on the boats and being involved in the project was also an experience of solidarity with each other, with people who understood the problem of Israel's colonization of and control and occupation of Palestine and shared a vision of what should be happening in a more just world. And there was a general strike in Italy. There was support from some governments around the world, a few, and from people beyond those who were on the boats. What was your understanding or experience of that solidarity?
The solidarity was so incredible. Just witnessing the crowds in Barcelona and Tunisia was something I'll carry with me my entire life. The sheer numbers of people that came out and the way that they expressed their solidarity in dancing and in music and in drawing photos. And even there was a woman in Barcelona that brought she's a toy maker, and she brought a bubble maker that she wanted us to deliver to someone in Gaza. So the people showing up in mass was incredible, but also the protests that happened with the Italian dock workers and the way that inspired the entire country to shut everything down in response to the flotilla was an enormous boon for the mission and to spread the awareness across the world. And we also had boats that were sent from many countries that, for performative reasons or otherwise, they felt compelled enough by their population that they needed to at least provide some level of support. And so Spain, Greece, Italy, and Turkey all sent boats to accompany us on the mission.
But none of those government boats intervened when Israel took 473 people hostage. And you were among those who was kidnapped and imprisoned in Israel.
Yes. Yeah. None of the boats that were sailing with us were there to actually defend us from an attack by Israel. I think that the reality is many of them fear the repercussions, either diplomatically or economically, from an actual defense of their own population that were on the boats. And it's sad that Israel has such impunity on international waters. Even earlier this year, Israel sent two missiles through the hull of another ship called the Conscience, and it was over 1,000 miles away from Israel. And no country has held Israel to account for that. And fortunately, again, nobody was killed in that attack, but there were people on the boat when it happened. And for these actions to happen, we need to understand these are acts of piracy, and they need to be held to account.
So given that sense of impunity that Israel has clearly developed because of the neglect of other nations in their responses to Israeli piracy, how did that affect, do you think, your treatment when you were kidnapped by Israel? What was that experience like?
Yeah, I was concerned. We had been also following there have been multiple movements of people, another called the Thousand Madleens, which actually sent a flotilla immediately after ours. But there have been many others that have also been coordinating their own resistance movements, either by land or by sea, to Gaza and to try to break the siege. And I was just concerned that Israel was going to try to use our flotilla because it was so much bigger than all of the others. that they wanted to put a stop to it. And previous flotilla missions, they had used terms like calling it a selfie yacht. So it was more focused on, it was attention seeking or whatever. But with our flotilla, they referred to us as terrorists. And how Israel defines the people that they're trying to attack is important because there's a track record or a pattern there. And I was concerned that they were going to try to attack our boats and potentially kill people on the boats in order to send a clear message that we were not allowed to resist empire. And then there was also the treatment and response that we were given in Israel or the occupied Palestinian territories and in Israeli prisons that also, you don't know what they're going to do to you, but you know, I was concerned for sure.
And what was that treatment like? How you taken into custody on the boat and moved to the prison, and what happened there? What kind of contact did you have with each other, with the outside world, with your national governments?
I didn't have any contact with the outside world the entire time I was in Israeli prison. And I would just say that the Israeli prison system is really designed just to dehumanize and to crush you. And they, to see even the cold-heartedness and the arrogance of the Israeli soldiers was just breathtaking to me. And even in the port of Ashdod, where we were taken initially, we were bound and forced to sit in a stress position for 6 hours until 3 in the morning. And then they started processing us into the prison system. And from there, they actually had to bus us hours down to the Negev Desert, where the Kitziat prison was located. It was actually near the border with Egypt. But the worst abuse that I received was them slamming me against a metal fence. And, you know, there's also humiliation tactics. They make you strip naked and do humiliating things in that situation. And they stole our valuables, even our medications, anything looking like a medication, which I'm pretty sure is a war crime. And it wasn't just the Israelis. It was also the U.S. government response to the U.S. citizens that had been arrested by Israel. Technically, Israel is a separate country, and we are supposed to be given consular services in an event like that, but it took them 3 days to be able to even meet with us in the prison. And that was after many other countries had already met with their citizens that were in the prison. Some of the other countries even brought their ambassador to the prison to meet with the detainees.
So the United States was just not as powerful or did not have an ambassador on the ground?
Apparently so. No, that's the line that they told us. They claimed to try to do everything that they could, working day and night to try to release us. But none of us believe that. In fact, they said that they had tried to bring in water and protein bars to us, but the Israelis wouldn't allow them. But we know for a fact that the Greek government, for example, was able to get coffee and cigarettes and chocolate to their detainees. But somehow the U.S. government does not have as much control as the Greek government when it comes to supporting its citizens in Israel. I don't think so. When you look at the policies of Mike Huckabee, which is the U.S. ambassador to Israel, and the entire U.S. relationship with Israel, it would be no surprise that they would want to make our stay in Israel as unpleasant as possible and withhold the support that they are required to offer to us. Even one of the things that they said when we were meeting with them, this is a direct quote, they said, "I'm sorry, but the U.S. has no jurisdiction over Israeli security affairs." And there were probably 10 of us men in a cage with them while they said that. And we all instantly broke out laughing because we essentially are funding the Israeli security affairs. So it's just ridiculous that they're telling us these lines.
So the U.S. eventually did get Americans released, however belatedly, after citizens of other countries had been released. And what's it been like since you've been back? How's your recovery been? What's your experience been returning to the U.S.?
It's been wonderful to be back home. And I am so grateful to friends and family in Portland that have been so supportive. Even my employer has been very understanding with the significant extra length of time that I was out from what we expected. But I am so happy to see so many people responding with questions and wanting to understand more and wanting to just talk about the experience. And even the response from local media, I'm so grateful that there has been some coverage of the flotilla. And ultimately, I want people to be able to see and understand not just what happened to me, but to translate that to how much worse it is for Palestinians, for example, that are in Israeli prisons. People are now just starting to discover that. And I think having someone that's local that was a part of that flotilla movement, it makes it feel a little bit more personal. And my hope is that people will find ways to get involved and resist these really degrading, inhumane, and abusive policies that our government is directly enabling by its support for Israel.
And what do you recommend for people who do want to get involved in addressing the U.S. government's policies, in helping the Palestinian people and cause? How can people find out more? How can people get involved?
I love the question. And I will say that there are so many people that were on the flotilla that took a special interest, I think, in the U.S. participants. Their eyebrows raised because everyone in the world knows that the U.S. is enabling this more than any other country by far. And so what Portlanders may not realize is their impact and their involvement has such a huge impact on this issue. So getting involved somehow is really, I would say, a duty, considering all of the abuse that has happened. And really the best place that I can think of is as like a starting off place is a website run by the Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, which is auphr.org. And people can go there and just sign up for a mailing list. And it's always current and gives local ways to prioritize getting involved and events that they can attend, actions they can do. I would encourage someone to follow that. And I have an Instagram account that I'm hoping to be able to send a message out soon with more local ways to show support and get involved as well. My Instagram account is at Global Thinker.
Well, thank you so much, Paul Reed, for talking with us and for your work on this important issue. Thank you so much.
I'm so grateful for you taking the time and for people having enough interest to listen to this important issue.
War is a murder, there's money at stake. Yeah, even Kushner agrees it's good at real estate. War is a murder, ask Netanyahu. He's got a song for that, he's got a bomb for you. War is a murder, it's an old desert faith. It's a nation state sanctioned righteous hate. Let's talk about dead people, I mean a dead people. War is a murder, it's the vengeance of God. If you can't see the bodies, they don't blow when they rot. And the flies don't swarm and the children don't cry. If war is a murder, good men don't die. So in a short 20 years, will you vacation the strip? Try not to think about the dead and have a nice trip.
That was some of Jesse Wells singing War Isn't Murder. And before that, you heard Paul Reed talking with me, Fran Michel, about his experience trying to break the blockade of Gaza and change the politics around Palestine.
Here's a poem by Muriel Rukeyser from her 1968 collection, The Speed of Darkness. I lived in the first century of world wars. Most mornings I would be more or less insane. The newspapers would arrive with their careless stories. The news would pour out of various devices, interrupted by attempts to sell products to the unseen. I would call my friends on other devices. They would be more or less mad for similar reasons. Slowly I would get to pen and paper, make my poems for others unseen and unborn. In the day, I would be reminded of those men and women, brave, setting up signals across vast distances, considering a nameless way of living, of almost unimagined values. As the lights darkened, as the lights of night brightened, we would try to imagine them, try to find each other, to construct peace, to make love, to reconcile waking with sleeping, ourselves with each other, ourselves with ourselves. We would try by any means to reach the limits of ourselves, to reach beyond ourselves, to let go the means, to wake. I lived in the first century of these wars. That was a poem by Muriel Rukeyser, republished at the Poetry Foundation. You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and you can support this station by clicking on the Donate tab on the KBOO app or webpage, or by texting KBOO to 44321. Thank you to all of KBOO's members, listeners, volunteers, and staff. And thanks to all the contributors to today's show. Paul Reed for talking with me about Palestine, Israel, and his experience with the flotilla. Lori Mercier and Aaron Kirschenbaum for their discussion of the environmental devastation of militarism and of Code Pink's War Is Not Green campaign to address it. Dunya McHale and Muriel Rukeyser for poetry. Joe Clement for our theme song. Billy Bragg for his song North Sea Bubble, which we heard a short clip from earlier. Jesse Wells for War Isn't Murder, and Dolly Parton and Ladysmith Black Mambazo for their cover of Yusuf Cat Stevens' Peace Train. We'll go out with a little more of that.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the community.